Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Before we get started, I want to remind everyone that we are now in our fall pledge drive, and you can donate today at kboo.fm/give. We aren't in the station to take your calls, but you can show your support by giving online. Again, that's kboo.fm/give. Or you can also mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. All summer, Trump has ranted about how Portland is being burned down by radical anarchist Antifa mobs. Of course, Portland has not burned down, but as we speak, much of Oregon actually is on fire. Wildfires inflamed by Trump's flagrant disregard and denial of impending climate chaos. Today, we talk with Ali Rosenbluth with Rogue Climate in Phoenix, Oregon, and Dominic Della Sala with Wild Heritage in Talent, who were both forced to evacuate from their homes in Talent last week. Later, we'll also talk with former wildfire fighter Tim Inglesby in Eugene and Eric DePlace with Sightline Institute in Seattle. These conversations are taking place as smoke chokes the Pacific Northwest and massive fires are still burning across the region. Our first guest is Ali Rosenbluth, Campaigns Director with Rogue Climate. Ali, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Hi, Barbara. Thanks for having me today.
First of all, how are you doing?
I am pretty tired and pretty shocked by what I'm seeing coming out of my community. I am still evacuated in the Little Applegate. I evacuated Talent with my roommate and our cat on Tuesday. And we are out here doing as much mutual aid support and coordination as we can with our organizer friends across the Rogue Valley, which has been really inspiring.
Let's just talk a little bit about the chronology of what happened.
On Tuesday, there was a fire started in Ashland that spread quickly because of the dry, hot summer that we're having, as well as pretty intense wind. So that combination led to the Almeda fire ripping across the Rogue Valley, burning parts of North Ashland, large chunks of the city of Talent, which is where I live, and also most of the city of Phoenix, including the Rogue Climate office, and parts of Medford. There are also fires in rural Jackson County, right on the proposed Pacific Connector pipeline route, in Shady Cove and Butte Falls. Those fires are happening as we speak right now on September 13th.
So you were able to evacuate, and I take it that everybody from Rogue Climate is okay?
Yeah, all of our staff and board are okay. There are volunteers and other community members whose homes have burned. We are right now making contact with folks who we know in the area to make sure everyone's okay and to see what they need and how we can support them right now. Of course, we're really upset that our office burned down, which was an office that we shared with the Rogue Action Center, which is a social justice organization based in the Rogue Valley. Our office was really a hub for organizing in the Rogue Valley. It was a place where we worked together, where we shared meals, where the campaigns to stop the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal and campaigns to pass 100% clean energy plan in Talent were run out of. But we know ultimately that our home isn't our office, our home is our community. And that's why we're really focused right now on getting aid to the folks who need it. There are thousands of people who have been displaced in our communities. A large chunk of them are Latinx farm workers, low-income folks, and people who are already struggling. So we are working as hard as we can to support those folks, which is why yesterday, actually, we launched the Rogue Valley Relief Fund, which is a partnership with other local groups that are on the ground in the Rogue Valley responding to this disaster, with the Mackenzie River Gathering Foundation to raise money that will go directly into the hands of people who have been impacted by this fire and who have the least access to resources in our communities.
So how can people donate to that fund?
You can donate to that fund at bit.ly/RV Fire Relief. And that's a link right there. You can also go to the MRG website and it'll be there. Or you can check out Rogue Climate's Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter page. And the link is there as well.
Let's talk about the short-term plans for the fund and the long-term plans.
Yeah, so short-term, we are wanting to get this money out as fast as possible. We've already actually been able to get $10,000 out in the first day of it opening back into our community. There are partner organizations that are working to make sure that that money can go back to people who have been impacted through Visa gift cards, through gas cards, through gift cards to get groceries, support that people really need right now. It's also helping folks with emergency housing, so people who need to pay for motel rooms. So that's pretty exciting that we've already been able to get some of that money right out into the community. And we also have been able to make sure that it's something that has the least amount of red tape as possible, and that is led and the decisions are made by community organizations and community leaders who are doing the work in the Rogue Valley. And then long term, we really hope that we are able to raise $500,000 or more to be able to really help people who have been impacted by this, whose homes have burned down, rebuild their lives here in the Rogue Valley. This is our home, and we love the Rogue Valley, and we are going to fight to make it a place that is livable and healthy and clean for all. And we will continue to do that even after this fire.
Well, there's like two concerns that I feel when I'm thinking about the fires all around the state, because they are burning many of my very favorite places in the world, including the Rogue Valley. And I'm wondering about looking at this kind of bifurcation between the natural places that are burned and what kind of impact that's going to have on those areas and on the communities. I mean, there's been a lot of photographs of the totally burnt out relics of Talent and Phoenix in particular. How do we work to support the causes of restoring both these parts of Southern Oregon?
I think it's really important to remember that this is what we have been expecting for years, looking at climate change and how climate change was going to impact the West Coast. These fires are a part of climate change. As we have drier, hotter summers, we have more dry vegetation that acts as fuels in our forests and our communities that help these fires spread more rapidly. We have to understand that this is a part of the world that is in climate chaos, and that politicians and fossil fuel corporations knew that this was going to happen and still haven't acted in a way that is urgent or bold enough to reduce climate pollution in our country and in the world. You know, so right now in Oregon, we are experiencing what climate chaos looks like. There are tens of thousands of people who are currently displaced in our state. We knew that was going to happen. We've read that. We've read those reports, and it's here. And we have to continue to take action. We have to continue to stop these terrible projects that bring us backwards, like the Klamath Methanol Refinery and the Jordan Cove LNG Export Terminal. And we also have to continue to push our leaders for systematic change that addresses the climate chaos in a real and bold way.
Well, one of the things that just chilled me as you were talking a few moments ago was mentioning the path of the fire, and that the path of one of the fires is following the Pacific Connected Gas Pipeline route. What would you say to Jordan Cove and to the people who are promoting this pipeline about the reality that we're seeing right now?
What I would say to any fossil fuel corporation right now is that they should be paying for this, not my community. And right now, I have to see my community pay for the irresponsible decisions that they have made, the negligence that they have made. And that is incredibly painful and unfair. And we have to stop using fossil fuels. And we have to start developing a way for our communities to be resilient in the face of climate change, because I never want to see my city in the news again like this. Just with all of these photos of the streets that I've walked my friend's dogs, just totally destroyed. I never want to see that again.
Yeah, I feel that way about the whole state of Oregon. I mean, it's been really astonishing to watch the entire western half of the state and then a small part of the eastern part of the state be struck by these fires that I don't think we could have ever imagined. And I think it really resonates with all of us about how much we love this place and what we would do to save it. And what I wonder is how we relate to the wildlands that are burning as well as the communities. And that's the thing that's different this time, is that we're used to wildland fires. We're not used to having urban fires. This is something we thought only happened in California. What kinds of alarms do you think this should raise for us?
We have known that this was going to hit Oregon eventually. We have known that this isn't a thing that will only happen in California. And I know our communities have been thinking about it a lot. When the campfire happened, people in Talent and Ashland and Medford and Phoenix were really, really terrified because it looked so familiar. And I know that we have built networks that have made mutual aid so much easier, which I think is so critical right now. And we have these networks that are able to get people the things that they need, which is incredibly important. But we also, once our communities are healed and people are able to get back to their regular lives, can't forget about this and can't forget that this was a piece of the climate disaster that we saw coming. And so I think that once Rogue Climate's able to build a new office, we're going to need a much bigger one, because I think there are going to be a lot more people who are ready to jump in and fight for climate action and demand that this is a thing that we never see again in our communities.
One other shout out I want to give is to Dan Sears and the folks up in Portland. I'm not sure who initiated the organizing of the supply chain coming from Portland down to your way, whether it came from your direction or came from up in Portland.
Yeah, so there are so many people in Portland who are throwing down so hard in solidarity with our communities in Southern Oregon, and I know across the state. In the last 2 days, there have been, I think, 3 different carloads of supplies from Portland, which has just been so heartwarming. And it's been just really incredible to see, like, the network that we've built in the Oregon climate movement, like, coming through at this time of disaster, and that we all really have each other's backs and care about each other's communities and are ready to show up when it's needed. So I'm feeling really grateful for our friends in Portland, our friends in Coos Bay, our friends on the East Coast who are sending money and making sure that people know how to give directly to community groups in Southern Oregon. It's huge. So I'm very grateful for so many people right now. I couldn't list them all. Yeah, I hope that COVID, the pandemic, ends soon so that I can give everybody a big hug.
I just thinking about how a lot of people in Portland have been focusing on what's going on in Clackamas County, because a lot of us who live in the south end of Portland felt pretty threatened by those fires too, and we're experiencing the smoke from them. But it's interesting to me, it's the activist community in Portland that's made the connection with Southern Oregon. What does that say to you?
I think that's a result of years of organizing together and years of relationship building and getting to know each other's communities. And I think that there are a lot of people who now have connections to Southern Oregon and want to and are showing up for the people who they care about and who they have these connections with, and the land that, you know, a lot of them have been fighting for.
Right now, everybody in Oregon is really focused on the fires. But in the back of our minds, there's like the comment period for the Kalama Methanol Refinery, which you mentioned. There's all these other things going on. Jordan Cove, I'm sure Pembina hasn't stopped trying to plot to get Jordan Cove built. How do you see balancing the ways that you rebuild your community and you rebuild as much as possible of Southern Oregon at the same time that you continue the fight and actually have to move the fight forward to stop fossil fuel projects?
I think what has been so illuminating about the fight to stop Jordan Cove is how many people it's brought together and how that is really so impactful right now and has made responding to this fire and getting people the things that they need a little bit easier. I think that people have now experienced what it's like to live in climate chaos in a really intense way, and that Jordan Cove is a local piece of that puzzle that we can control, and that we will have to continue to make sure that that project is stopped for good. We have to continue to show that that is not a viable project, and we have to prioritize supporting people in our communities who have lost everything because of these fires. And so that's why at Rogue Climate, we're really focused right now on supporting our community. And again, if you are able to donate to the Rogue Valley Relief Fund, please, please do so. It is incredibly important and impactful to help support people who need this money right now, who have lost everything.
Well, Ellie, you are all an inspiration to me, and I wish you the best. And I urge everybody to help support your fight to get back on your feet again. So good luck with everything. Say hi to everybody, in particular your roommate and your cat, Dante.
Thank you. Bye, Barbara.
Bye-bye. We've been talking with Ellie Rosenbluth, campaigns director with Rogue Climate, and you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking about the fires that are ravaging Oregon and the rest of the West. We'll talk now with Dominic Della Sala, chief scientist with Wild Heritage in Southern Oregon, who has just returned to his home in Talent after having to evacuate last week. Dominic, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thanks. Always a pleasure to be on your show, Barbara.
First of all, I just want to know how you're doing.
You know, I'm one of the fortunate evacuees down here in Southern Oregon. I live in Talent, which experienced a major urban wildfire, as we all know, and it took out huge sections, residential homes downtown, about four blocks from my front door. So it was all frightening, sad to see, and now we're all trying to help people that have lost everything in this fire. I only had to deal with about a week of living on couches and not having power or water at my house, but I'm back and trying to help people now.
Well, you sent me some photographs a couple days ago of some of the devastation. What was it, four blocks from your house? I wonder if you could describe what the scene looks like around where you live.
You know, it is a stark contrast in how this fire affected homes on one side of Talent Avenue and left them unscorched directly adjacent on the other side. So on the east side of Talent Avenue, the devastation was incredible. It was widespread. It took out, I don't know, dozens, if not over 100 homes in a corridor sweep that went all the way up to Ashland and down to Phoenix. It started in Ashland, by the way, and also in Phoenix through arson. And right across the street on Talent Avenue, on the west side of the street, homes were untouched. And it made me really start to look at what the heck happened here. What's the difference? But it's a stark contrast in homes that were prepared versus homes that weren't prepared in what was a raging urban fire that had nothing to do with forest management. Structures were the fuels in this fire, and high winds pushed it miles through the corridor in lightning speed.
A lot of us were watching with horror 2 years ago when Paradise, California just about totally was burnt up. And at the time, and I think you and I talked about this,
yeah,
and we were looking at aerial photographs, and what you pointed out was that the buildings all burned, but the trees weren't burning. I had two thoughts at the time, which made me feel a little smug as an Oregonian. And one was, a lot of the destruction in Paradise was in these little cul-de-sacs, these little suburban cul-de-sacs that were tucked into the woods. And we have very little of that in Oregon. And then the other part of my smugness was, well, we're just too wet to have this kind of thing happen. Now, Allie, who I just talked to, was saying that they were watching the campfire 2 years ago with horror, feeling that they could be next. So I'm wondering, what do you see are the lessons of the campfire and how they apply to what you're going through right now?
Southern Oregon right now is the new paradise, tragically. And, you know, I can't even convey the emotions involved in the damage that has occurred down here. I mean, this is unprecedented in anyone's lifetime. And incredibly sad to see, because it could have been avoided largely. Myself and several other scientists have been sending letters and testifying in Congress and in the state legislature as well, asking elected officials to stop focusing on logging in the backcountry and instead put every dollar into preparing communities for these kinds of disaster prevention issues. And we were ignored, largely. This is a climate change issue, and it's an issue of poor urban planning that's been going on for decades, building in places that are prone to burn at some point. We saw that in the Tubbs Fire in the 1960s. There was only a handful of structures that burned. And a few years ago, when it passed over the same fire footprint, it took out hundreds of homes. You know, we're built in the wrong places. Unfortunately, without disaster preparation, much of the West is going towards uninhabitable conditions. And this is my biggest fear, that unless the elected officials start paying attention to climate change that's triggering these unprecedented urban fire disasters, and on the East Coast, it's hurricanes that, you know, Alabama's experiencing that right now. This is all related to climate chaos and a lack of proper urban planning. So going forward, we need a redesign of Western communities for preparing for these kinds of disasters. We were totally unprepared for this, and it was complete chaos here during the evacuation period, where there was no coordinated communication system, it was hard to get information, there was no traffic being directed along evacuation routes, and it just was chaos.
In the fires here in Oregon, a lot of the communities that are being burnt are old established communities, particularly along the Mackenzie River and also in Clackamas County. How do you feel things have changed? Do you think that there's been as much development in Jackson County and Josephine County in the last 20 years as there's been, for example, in Sonoma County in California?
The West is experiencing development all around. I mean, this is a great place to live. We all know that. It's quality of life, right? You know, there are now millions of homes that are built in harm's way that weren't there in the 1960s. And whether you're in Jackson County or up in the Portland area or anywhere else in these desirable Western towns, they've experienced this unmitigated growth, lack of land zoning for fire concerns. It's often opposed by developers and land property rights folks. And, you know, this is what we're dealing with right now. The aftermath of really poor urban planning. And there's a way forward on this. You know, we can see some of the silver lining in this dark cloud that we're facing and can move together as a community so that this never happens again. And that's going to take a lot of hard work. It's going to take some policy changes and some recognition that we can't just go back and do the same thing over again and expect a different outcome.
One thing that I really notice about the difference between the fires going on right now and the fires we're familiar with in Oregon is that this is the first time that they've actually burned in urban areas. Usually our fires are way out in the woods and they may be affecting small rural communities. Why is it that this time around, it's cities like Talent and Phoenix and all the small communities along the Mackenzie River that have burned? Why are these places, which I don't think we thought of as being that close to the wildland areas, why are they on fire?
We had this alignment of these factors that all came together at the same time. In climate science, we call this a black swan event. And black swan events are a series of cataclysmic, seemingly interlinked events that occur in a domino sequence. Oddly enough, this is the weird thing, Barbara. I was writing an op-ed about this when my power went out and I ran outside to see, you know, maybe my lines were down and I could see the smoke approaching my house. And I got up on the roof and started hosing down my house. But, you know, the point being, we've been writing about this for years. These interlinked conditions that trigger large catastrophic events. The conditions that were at play at the time was unprecedented low humidity levels. There's parts of our region that were down into the single digits of humidity, on top of which we would be dealing with triple digit temperatures for several weeks down here. And then we had an east flow wind system with gusts up to 40 or 50 miles an hour. All of those combined with arson-related triggers that then swept through the urban corridor at incredibly rapid speeds. I mean, within hours, entire communities were burning to the ground as the towns became the fuels for these urban wildfire disasters. And, you know, those events were all interlinked at some unique moment in time when we are now dealing with the hard consequences of poor planning and climate chaos. And my fear is, again, much of the West is heading towards uninhabitable conditions, just like much of the East Coast with hurricanes is heading in that direction because we continue to ignore the issue of climate chaos.
Well, do you think this is going to be a wake-up call? I mean, for people other than Donald Trump, who claimed in California on Tuesday that the fires are caused by downed trees exploding and that it's actually going to get colder soon. Do you think that this is a wake-up call for a lot of other people that might make a difference?
Like the pandemic, if we ignore this, it doesn't go away. If we don't test for it, it doesn't go away. It just gets worse, right? So we need real action, and we needed it for several decades. And we're running out of time. We've got, by most accounts, a decade to drastically cut our emissions and prepare for these kinds of disasters. And you know, the optimist in me says, wow, this is interesting that we've got governors now that are calling these climate fires. You know, Jay Inslee in Washington and Newsom in California have been pushing back on Trump, saying this is, you know, these are climate fires. You're ignoring what's going on here. You're, you know, totally insensitive to the loss of life and loss of property, and you're just trying to move on as if it never happened. That's the plus side. On the negative side, so far, the elected officials are jumping all over. We need to do more logging in the backcountry. This is the wrong direction. For example, Senator Wyden's got a lot of good provisions in his recent bill, the 21st Century Conservation Corps. However, the funding that he's asking for is directing $6 billion of aid largely to do more forest thinning and only $100 million on helping people deal with this tragedy. That $100 million is going to go quickly when you've got over 40,000 evacuees in Southern Oregon alone and thousands of homes that have been destroyed. $100 million is not enough. Every dollar we spend logging in the backcountry is a dollar we're not using to help people with this incredible disaster. Every dollar and every resource now needs to be focused on helping these communities deal with this tragic loss and rebuild their lives, not logging in the backcountry.
Now, you said at the beginning that there's ways that people can protect their homes, and that's what we need to move forward to in the future. So what should people who live close to wildland areas do to protect their home, and how effective do you think that will be?
There's a huge social injustice issue with all of these environmental issues, and it seems to be the case down here. Most of the destruction was in low-income housing. A lot of migrant workers that are, you know, picking the fields down here and providing us with crops are now without homes. And there's been a lot of loss of senior housing development down here. These are all economically challenged people. It's a social injustice crisis that we see across the board with all of our environmental issues. You know, the rich people are just, you know, they'll move somewhere else. It's mostly the low-income people that are suffering here. And what I observed, and again, I don't have data on this. This is just my cursory observations of walking along Talent Avenue. On the east side of the street, most of the homes that burned down were mobile homes. And the scary part of this is I was listening at night when the fire first hit to exploding propane tanks, because these mobile homes all depend on propane for their cooking purposes. And so they just went up in a domino sequence. They weren't home hardened. They were surrounded by, you know, trees. Everyone loves to have the shade of trees around their house. And this is not how you design fire-safe communities. And across the street, the newer developments, you know, the richer people are, did not experience any burn effect because those structures were, you know, they're newer, they're built to code, they didn't have the propane issue, and, you know, they weren't closer to that urban corridor where the wind was funneling. But, you know, at least the contributing factor here is preparing the homes by hardening them, by closing off and screening vents, clearing out gutters from flammable leaves, making sure there's no vegetation within a 50 to 100 foot radius around the home that could ignite the structure. I mean, we know the science on this. We know how to prepare communities. We're just not doing it. And it's going to take a complete retrofit. And $100 million is not nearly enough to do what's necessary here to prepare for more of these black swan events.
So in the coming days, what are your plans, Dominic, both personally and on, let's say, a political and social level?
Yeah, this is personal to me. I've been a climate change and biodiversity scientist slash activist all my career, but right now it's outside my door, four blocks away. I've had friends and people that I know lost everything. I feel really motivated to get the word out to the media, to get folks down here to see what happened and how this tragedy could have been avoided with better planning. And I need to get that message out to every decision maker, from local county commissioners and state representatives to congressionals. And eventually, you know, if we get a change in the White House, we'll be talking to the incoming administration about taking some real climate actions that support the states in their efforts to cut emissions and to protect forests as a means to store carbon, rather than polluting the atmosphere with more logging-related emissions. We're not getting out of this fix easily or quickly unless we get off of fossil fuels and store more carbon in forest ecosystems instead of cutting them down and releasing that carbon and contributing to more of these disasters that we're dealing with right now.
Well, Dominic, I hope in the coming days that your power supply becomes a little bit more reliable and you can stay online and do all the work that you're doing. I want to thank you so much for what you're doing and also for your very clear descriptions of what it's like to live in a wildfire zone. So thanks for being here on Locus Focus.
Yeah, thanks, Barbara. And again, I'm one of the fortunate ones. I really feel for my neighborhood, you know, that took it a lot more severely than I did.
We've been talking with Dominic De La Sala, chief scientist with Wild Heritage in Southern Oregon. And you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking about the fires that are ravaging Oregon and the rest of the West Coast. Now we'll talk with former Wildlands firefighter Tim Inglesby, co-founder and executive director of Firefighters United for Safety, Ethics, and Ecology. Hi, Tim. Welcome to Locus Focus.
Hi. Thank you.
We've been talking to some people down in Talent for the first part of this show. And so now we're moving up to the Willamette Valley. First of all, I just wanted to get a perspective from you of how things are going. You're in Eugene, correct?
Correct.
So how far are you from the fires along Mackenzie River?
Well, we're several miles away, and there's a lot of intervening land between the edge of the fire and where I live. But my son works at a business just a few blocks away from the evacuation zone, and we're feeling it all. My heart really goes out to those who have lost everything, lost loved ones, lost their homes. Other people have been uprooted in their lives from evacuations, and then all of us feeling the cumulative effects of the smoke. There's a real pall of sorrow and grief hanging over us, but I do see hope, and we got to hold on to that hope, especially when it feels hopeless.
Well, I've been spending a lot of time realizing what I'm trying not to think about, which is what so much of Oregon looks like. And these are places I'm really attached to. I've spent a lot of time in a lot of these areas that are burning. I'm wondering, how do you feel about knowing that this really beloved landscape is burning, besides the loss of homes and lives, which is really almost impossible to imagine in Oregon? This is what happens in California, not what happens in Oregon. So beyond that, what do you feel about the impact this is going to have on the landscape?
The Holiday Farm fire and up to Mackenzie, I was really stressed about that. But the few photos we've seen in the news media show a very strange picture. Gray mounds of ash where the Community Blue River once stood, and hundreds of homes gone. But standing above them are these big green trees with their canopies barely singed. And that's a sharp contrast. You know, what happened here? Didn't these burn in a forest fire? No, that was an urban fire. But then what's for travelers on the highway up the Mackenzie River, they're going to see an even more horrific scene, because the fire burned mainly in the industrial timberland of Weyerhaeuser and other private landowners. And those tree farms are highly vulnerable. They burn catastrophically for a number of reasons. What we're going to see is kind of like going back in time to when those clear cuts were first put in place, like in the 1980s, and they were just barren moonscapes. Well, they've grown over with young trees since then, but those trees have now fried. And so we're going to go back to those moonscapes. And it's going to be quite a traumatic scene to people for a long time to come.
Well, I'm also thinking about the lessons learned, because you and Dominic and other people I've talked to over the years have emphasized how forest management is not about thinning trees, particularly rather large trees that they try to thin, but it's really about understanding ecosystems and understanding that ancient forests are pretty fireproof. So how does this demonstrate some of the things that you've been talking about for so long?
Well, I mean, Trump and the timber industry, they really got it wrong in that the lack of forest management has caused these wildfires. Just look what happened up the Mackenzie River. It's really forest over-management that is a big part of the severe effects of some of these fires. And then on public lands, it's more the under-management of fire that has been the problem. We've been just stomping out on all fires, you know, as quick as possible when we can. And then we come this weird and wild weather from climate change causing a regional east wind event. We can't put those out. So it's a problem when you say forest management. What are you really talking about? If that's just a euphemism for all commercial timber extraction and then tree plantations, well, that's more deforest management. And it's a very, very big difference between a tree farm and a native forest in terms of the resiliency to fire.
Let's talk about the resiliency that native forests actually have.
Well, you know, I also care about the Beechey Creek fire that burned in Oval Creek Wilderness and then spread out through the community of Brighton Bush. And there again, you know, just tragic loss of much of the Hot Springs Resort was destroyed. Maybe most or all of that community of summer cabins near Brighton Bush destroyed. Many of my friends, we lost some people even. Homes are destroyed by fire, but the forest often is rejuvenated by fire. We're really talking about two different kinds of fire. Wildfires that burn in wild lands versus wooey fires that burn in the wildland-urban interface. This summer, like no other, is a real teachable moment. We live in homes that are far more flammable than the surrounding forest. And even if Opal Creek, that gorgeous ancient forest there, burned and many of the trees were killed by the fire, if they're not logged, then all the seeds that have been laying dormant in the soil, they're not going to be disturbed by, you know, felling trees and dragging them across slopes. They will, you know, sprout, and we'll see a carpet of flowers and morel mushrooms and all kinds of critters that are still inhabiting the forest. Many plants and animals have evolved with recurring fires as a kind of ecological stimulus to them, more than what we call a natural disturbance or natural disaster. Those are what affect our homes and communities. The forests are going to recover. We should not grieve so much. They'll change for sure. The scenery will change, but in some ways the ecology will be enhanced in some of these wild lands that burned forest. And particularly, they burn very spotty. Within these large fire perimeters, extremely large, are unburned green islands where the fire skipped over or skipped around, lightly burned, underburned areas, a real mosaic that is really another benefit that this kind of pyrodiversity really enhances biodiversity by making a rich mix of different habitats, unlike the communities that just burned uniformly, destructively. The dominant image of those wildfires in the news media are burning homes and incinerated communities, and that's tragic and it's terrible. But the fires in the wildlands, we're still yet to get out there and assess and see for ourselves. What were the effects?
I find it kind of interesting that there's been this wildfire burning on the southeast slope of Mount Hood now for about 5 weeks, the White River Fire. It was a lightning strike. It threatened some homes that were close by in the woods, but very, very few people live out that way. And I wonder how we compare that kind of fire with the fire that, particularly the Beechey Creek fire, that just stormed down the Sandy Am Canyon.
The White River fire did get my attention because a firefighter was killed on that, a helicopter pilot. This is a powerful force of nature, and we are mere mortal human beings. Unless and until we shift our whole paradigm of fighting fire in all places, at all times, at all costs, we're just going to keep having tragedy after tragedy. The time is to start working with fire, you know, maximize its ecological benefits, minimize its social impacts, you know, mitigate the risks and hazards to firefighters and people where we can. Unless we get to that more nuanced and complex relationship with fire, I don't see how this summer is going to be any different from next summer and the summers to come, you know, because we're going to continue to have climate change getting ever worse. We're going to continue to have, wildfires as we had for the last 400 million years on the planet. This is time for change, and I hope this season is a real teachable moment.
Well, just a couple months ago, we were talking about what your fears were for about this fire season. And I don't recall us quite coming up with this scenario, but how do you compare what you were thinking about when we talked in July and what you've seen here in the last week and a half?
Yeah, I was genuinely fearful for firefighters because of the risk of COVID compounded by this reverse to the policy of the 1930s of fighting every fire. Best of intentions to eliminate smoke impacting communities, but those firefighters are, you know, sticking their lungs right on the line there. And I was really concerned about that. much to everyone's surprise, the spread of infection through firefighters is much less than we had feared. But I caution, we are barely halfway through the season. I mean, Southern California's fire season is really yet to come, and they've been on fire since August. There's just a cumulative impact of this fighting fires and beating young bodies up. Otherwise strong and healthy young bodies, months of smoke inhalation, sleep deprivation, arduous labor, poor hygiene, bad food. It takes a toll. Otherwise healthy people can just be sick from that, let alone this other risk of COVID. And it's also weighing on every firefighter's mind. They've got friends and family back home, you know, dealing with a pandemic. We're in a much better place than many epidemiologists perhaps expected, but we still have a long way to go.
As far as the severity of the fires that we're seeing, did you have any sense that that was possible when we were talking 2 months ago?
You know, that is a really great question. I have to say, honestly, I'm shocked, but not surprised, because certainly this is how the ancient forest of the West Side Cascades, this is how they burn. They burn, you know, with these big fires. In fact, all the forests that we see today were born in the last big fire. But this kind of freakish region-wide east wind event is really a climate signal. Climate change is real. It's happening. And it does happen, usually in late fall and high in the mountains in a very, you know, relatively small locale, not the entire spine of the Cascades, down into California. It's one of those once in every 100 years or more type of event that we're seeing more and more frequently because of climate change.
Do you know if that is something that's ever happened historically before?
I don't know. I mean, it's possible prehistorically that this happened. From Baja to BC was a huge, explosion of fire. But bear in mind, this is just kind of a continuum of even this 1 year alone. The horrific fire season in Australia was kind of the worst in their nation's record. People fleeing to the ocean shore. It looked like a scene out of the escape from Dunkirk, okay? Waiting for rescue from ships. We had fires in Amazonia and the Arctic. And, you know, before this smoke from the fires in Oregon, we were catching the drift from fires in Russian Siberian tundra. It is a global phenomenon, because it's a global impact of fossil-fueled climate change. That really is, again, the burning issue of our time. After the rains come and the snows fall and the fires go out and the smoke goes away, we're still going to have the planet heating up and priming the pump for fire seasons like this occurring more frequently year after year.
Well, I want to get back to a more positive note.
Yes, thank
you. You were talking earlier about the resilience of ancient forests. And I was having a conversation with a friend a few days ago who actually is not in Portland at the moment. She's up in outside of Bellingham, and so she's escaping the worst of the smoke. And we had a very disturbing conversation when I was letting her know what was really going on here. And we do a lot of hiking together, and she was mourning that the forests weren't going to be able to grow back because the topsoil was being removed. This is what I told her. I want to make sure I was right. But I remember when I was visiting the Biscuit Burn, we could see it. The topsoil had been burned away, but you were seeing all this bare grass and all this incredible things coming back. This was about 4 years after the fire. So am I correct in saying it doesn't matter that the topsoil burns away?
You know, what's mostly burned away is the top layers of litter and duff. These kind of mats of decaying, you know, needles and limbs, that's what's mostly burned away. Only the most severe fires really burn deep into the topsoil and consume the organic matter buried beneath the soil surface. That's probably has happened in some places. But as long as it's not compounded by an additional disturbance, you know, slamming logs down and dragging them up and down steep slopes, that would be devastating to the exposed soils. But left alone, the recovery is already happening. There's green shoots poking up through the gray ash right now. And when trees do fall down as natural logs, they're like little check dams for the soil.
They don't explode, like Trump said?
They don't explode. They'll be like little check dams for the soil. And each one of those standing trees, even dead, provides really important barriers to the sun and the wind and retains soil so that the trees that are other vegetated grow right now still have some protection from the other elements. It's remarkable. And I encourage anyone, stand in the middle of the most severely burned
forest is still relatively cool and moist, go step out into a burned clear cut and you fry. There's a stark contrast there.
So as a former firefighter, what do you think can be done to prepare for the next fire season?
That's the word, prepare. You know, and we need a lot more planning and preparation on the front end, long before the first whiff of smoke in here, to begin with, like, make sure our communities are really prepared for fire. In many cases, communications broke down, folks had no warning, and it was a mass evacuation, and it was instant traffic jams. The first fire crews on the scene didn't even engage the fire. They were kind of being traffic control cops, helping people safely evacuate, which is what they should be doing, right? So more planning and preparation for our communities to be, you know, safe in the event of fire. And then in terms of fire on the land, and factoring all the weather and terrain and vegetation, we are amazingly good at predicting where fires are going to go and what they're going to do. Fires that ignite from a lightning strike in early spring, burning under moderate conditions, are basically doing that, you know, fuels reduction for free. Why would we want to stomp it out? If anything, we could be working with it, help steer it into places we know, hey, it needs a good fire, and steer it away from places like rural homes and communities that where you can't tolerate any fire. So planning and preparation to be more opportunistic in taking advantage of these fires that are doing good work that help restore ecosystems deprived of fire and protect communities from fire. What we should be doing right now over the winter, planning or preparing for the fires to come.
Well, Tim, it's really good to talk to you. And thanks for all the work that you've been doing trying to warn us. I hope that now that you're getting some national media attention, that your warnings will be heard.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate being here.
And stay safe.
Thank you. You too.
We've been talking with former Wildlands firefighter Timothy Inglesby, co-founder and executive director of Firefighters United for Safety, Ethics, and Ecology. And you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking about the fires that are ravaging Oregon and the rest of the West Coast. Now we'll talk with Eric DePlace at Sightline Institute in Seattle. Eric, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having me back, Barbara. It's good to see you this time.
Well, let's talk about these times that we're in. I'll just let people know that you're the furthest north of any of the people that I'm talking to today, and you're up in Seattle. So I'm kind of curious about your perspective of looking southward, what you're seeing and how you're responding to it.
Multiple times a day, I actually check the air quality on one of the various air quality maps that we have. And it's just been horrifying to watch, you know, first the situation in California, which was rough for a long time, and then the situation in Oregon develop and become just an absolute disaster. But you know, it's like I was saying to a friend earlier today, it's an ongoing disaster. It's like a nightmare that won't end. The air quality is terrible. The smoke is thick. There are still lots of people missing. And there doesn't seem to be any immediate end in sight. We've got it bad here in Seattle. Actually, the air quality is terrible here. But it's about half as bad as what's going on in Portland. And maybe a third as bad as what's going on in Eugene. So really a rough situation for the Northwest.
Until recently, I thought that the Northwest was going to be a refuge from climate chaos. And our biggest concern was getting all these climate chaos refugees pushing in on Oregon. Instead, we are becoming a poster child for the worst excesses. Maybe not the worst excesses, but some serious excesses of climate chaos. So how do you see this shift? And is this something that you were expecting to see so quickly or at all?
I don't know. I mean, it's right. The Northwest has the worst air quality in the world right now. And we've been in that seat for the last week or so. And we're probably going to stay there for another at least a few days. And we're the worst by a long shot. Like, it's not close. It illustrates that the ravages of climate change, we can predict them in broad terms, but we don't know exactly when they're going to arrive or how intense they're going to be. We don't necessarily get spared the ravages of climate change because we've been virtuous or because we've been working to prevent climate change. That doesn't mean we get off the hook. We're going to suffer maybe just as much as people on the Gulf Coast who are also suffering from the impacts of climate change. It feels like riding the dragon right now. And I mean, it's not totally unpredictable because there are scientific projections that let us know that this stuff is coming and it's going to get worse. But it's awfully discouraging, I think, for a lot of folks who have spent their careers working to protect the planet and working to reduce their impact on the climate, to all of a sudden find themselves in a position where we might become climate refugees ourselves.
It's kind of ironic in a way that all summer Trump has been pointing to Portland as a place where the fires are burning because of Antifa mobs. And at the same time, of course, he's been doing everything possible to exacerbate the increase in greenhouse gas emissions and all the other environmental horrors he's trying to perpetrate on us. Now the fires are burning all around Oregon, actually not in Portland. I wonder if we see a connection between what's happening politically and these immense fires that are, well, a lot of people are talking about feeling like we're at the threshold of apocalypse.
Yeah, the threshold of apocalypse might be too modest in a way. I mean, there's almost something that feels literary about it. Like, this entire year has been the story of being unable to breathe. I mean, from George Floyd to the COVID pandemic, which is, of course, a respiratory illness, to the fires. There's something that feels both literally and figuratively like we're being choked to death, like we're smothering. And I think what's concerning for me, but I think for a lot of folks, is that I don't know how we get out of this jam. Like, it's possible that Trump won't be reelected in November, but we're not going to get out of the problem with wildfires, right? Not soon, anyway. We don't have a near-term way to get out of the racial justice crisis that we have in this country, and the COVID pandemic is going to be with us for a while longer, too, at least. I don't want to head toward a place of despair, but, you know, things are rough right now. I mean, I feel very fortunate for my relative privilege and position, because a lot of people have it much, much worse. They've lost property, they've lost their jobs, they've lost their lives in some cases. It's hard to look around at civilization or at the Northwest right now and think, wow, we're really doing great, because we're not.
Throughout this whole strange year, I've considered myself to be fortunate. First, with the pandemic, I was fortunate that I owned my own house. It was paid for. I lived in a neighborhood where I could get out on walks, so I wasn't like trapped in my house. I knew people were suffering immensely. And yet, so there was sort of this normal, though, that I accepted. Well, I'm learning how to live with the pandemic, and I'm lucky that it's not going to affect me as much. And then the Black Lives Matter movement started. That was like the one high point of this year. But when Portland was under siege by the far right and by these white supremacists coming in with Trump flags and banners and threatening people downtown Portland, I started to feel a little bit less comfortable. I felt like, well, fascism is really starting to set down some roots. We can't escape from that. And now with the fires, I'm just feeling lucky that I didn't have to evacuate. So my level of what's feeling lucky, the bar is going lower and lower and lower. And I just wonder how much lower it can go.
I mean, unfortunately, I think the bar can go quite a bit lower. I mean, we are still, by any historical or global standard, you know, doing really well. And I think that's what's so worrisome. I spend probably an unhealthy amount of my time reading world history. And I'm reading a book right now on Portuguese contact in the Amazon basin and what colonization was like in South America. You know, you can't find words for it. It's so horrific. We are still very, very privileged. And that in itself makes it almost more alarming that there is so far for us to fall potentially. And all of a sudden, I think we're having this moment of really trying to wonder, you know, is our civilization not just sustainable in the sense of like, are we over consuming resources, but like, will it survive into next year? Will it survive for 10 years from now? For me, as for a lot of parents, it freaks me out for my kid who has already been evacuated from a wildfire once in his life, who was in a basement when Hurricane Sandy hit on the East Coast, who's going to school during a pandemic. Like, his childhood, his life is radically different than mine was at his age. And I fear that by the time he's 46, which is how old I am, he'll have a bunch of war stories, hopefully not literal ones, but maybe, that are going to put anything I've got in the shade.
I find it interesting that it's been Donald Trump who's been presiding over this whole misery. And like, we can't blame him for everything. We can't really even blame him for the wildfires. But I just wonder about the symbolism or whatever of having someone like him leading what used to be the most powerful country in the world and maybe leading us into oblivion.
I oscillate between just despair and sometimes mockery, but he's a caricature of stupidity. He's a caricature of evil almost. Like he will do the wrong thing every time. And instead of providing compassion or support for people, he will antagonize them or attack them at exactly the wrong moment. It's hard to even invent a worse possible leader to have at a time like this, trying to essentially erode the foundations of American democracy in ways that are increasingly clear all the time. Contrast that to the leadership in the Northwest, leaders that I frequently disagree with, sometimes robustly. I'll mention the governor of Oregon and the governor of Washington, but both of whom are shining examples of actually caring about their places and actually doing the best they can with the resources available and actually taking science seriously. Fundamentally, I believe that Governor Brown, Governor Inslee, and many, many others in the Northwest are trying hard to do the right thing in very difficult circumstances. I wish we had leadership like that at the federal level, and we just don't.
There seem to be some lessons that maybe are starting to be learned. Do you see that there's a way that we can use this moment to move forward in a way that keeps us from going over the cliff of oblivion?
I sure hope so. I think there's no question that people are paying attention to climate change now to a degree that maybe they haven't ever before. The national media can't report this story any other way. They're reporting it accurately. There are multiple drivers of fire, but climate is accelerating everything and making everything worse. And that's clear. And actually, that I think that nuance is even coming through in the stories. That feels really positive to me. I mean, we clearly have to invest quickly now in a lot of wildfire management and adaptation measures, or more people will die and we'll have a lot more loss. And ultimately, we have to figure out how to address the climate crisis and reduce carbon concentrations in the atmosphere. This stuff all remains possible to do. We already have all the technology we need. We have already all of the economic plans that we need to do this stuff. What we have lacked, the only thing that we've lacked, and it's a big thing, but it's political will to do it. Maybe it's the nature of the work that I do, but I can't stop being at least partially optimistic, because we have solved already so many of the key problems. We just have to do the right thing. I spent a lot of my time working in Appalachia now, working with communities that have been devastated by the loss of jobs and economy and culture from the coal industry collapsing out there and from the steel industry collapsing out there. Those folks are learning to reconstitute themselves and reinvest in their communities. And I actually believe, I know this sounds nuts sometimes, when we dismantle capitalism or reconfigure it in a way that actually can sustain itself, I sort of think that it's going to be led by communities that have been beaten down the hardest like that have been discarded, ground up by the system. That could be communities in Oregon that have been incinerated by a wildfire. It could be coal communities in Kentucky that have gone down really hard. There are signs of hope in the people, in the activists, in the kids, in every one of those places. And because I'm fortunate enough to get to talk to them, I find it impossible to completely lose hope.
Well, that's great to hear. And in the meantime, until we talk again, I hope that you take care and you get an air filter for your house.
Thanks, Barbara. I need it. Good luck to you,
Thanks
too.
Thanks a lot, Eric. We've been talking with Eric DePlace at Sightline Institute in Seattle, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, Coast Community Radio in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KBOO Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KBOO staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KBOO on the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And you can help us through these difficult times if you're able by becoming a member of KBOO during this fall pledge drive or renewing your membership. Again, that's kboo.fm/give, or you can also mail a contribution to the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. Also, if you want to help support relief efforts in Southern Oregon, you can contribute to the Rogue Valley Relief Fund. Go to rogueclimate.org and click on Donate. Next week, we'll talk with Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper about hearings now going on concerning the world's largest methanol refinery proposed for Kalama, Washington. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We'll go out with music by Cassandra Wilson. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, and remember to wear a mask.
Yesterday's news is tomorrow's blues. But today I am alive. Today I did much more than survive.
Ooh, I learned to live by the love I give. It's the only thing I Shadowed valleys that I've known help me build my home.
So tell me why.
Why should I be afraid?
Why should you be afraid? We've seen brighter, we've seen darker.